Okay. I'm going to apologize in advance for not being at my office hours after class today. I'm going to do the valuation boot camp for the MBA ones. Some of you might have taken it. No. I've been doing it every year for the last 10, where I essentially in 60 minutes give them all the valuation they need to know to talk to an investment banker. 60 minutes is probably too long to be able to do, but you know, you can pretty much cover everything you need. So if you're interested in getting another hour on valuation, come by. I think it's in 170 or 260. In fact, I've got to figure out where it is. That's a dangerous place to be. So that's at 12 to 1. And did you like my pricing of the Venetian? I thought it was kind of fun. I got in, I took the picture. I'm going to make this, I think, a standard practice. Wherever I go, I'm going to take a picture of the in-house menu, multiply by, add 5 zeros, and multiply by the number of rooms. I'll be pricing hotels right and left. So, but if you get a chance, take a look at that document that I sent you. Most of it is crap. So treat it as crap. So there's all this thing they talk about, discounted cash flow valuations, but the heart's not in it. But take a look at that section on the soda can. I think it's the most illuminating part of the whole thing. And especially like the last sentence where they say, users are advised to use this approach with caution. You read that? Because hotels have been known to misprice their soda cans relative to their real estate value. Okay, take that for whatever it's worth. No? But that's pricing. It's as simple as that. So today we're going to continue our discussion of pricing. Let's do what we usually do. Do a few tests to make sure we're getting this stuff. So let's say I come to you with three companies, and this is a slam dunk. Most of you should be able to get it. Let's see if you can get it. Three companies, they all have the same cost of equity. They're in the same business. The only difference is company A has a return equity of 12%, company B has a return equity of 10%, company C has a return equity of 8%. Which of these three companies is most likely to be trading at below book value, and why? C, and what is it about C that's going to make it trade below book value? You're earning a return on equity less than your cost of equity. You should trade it below book value. So company C wakes up to this and says, we've got to do something about this. So they get the accountants in. The accountants manage to take this huge write-off that shrinks their book equity by 50%. So I have a very simple mechanical question. You've got a restructuring charge. You've reduced your book equity by half. Remember, this company used to trade it below book value before this happened. What's going to happen to the price-to-book ratio of this company right after the write-off? It's going to go up. In fact, it's going to roughly double. Why? Because the market doesn't care that you're writing off a past mistake, which is what you're doing. So your price-to-book ratio is going to double. You're saying, this is awful. What's going to happen to its return equity? It's also going to double. And that's why whenever you talk about price to book, you always want to bring return on equity to the discussion. Do you see why? Because otherwise, I can play accounting games on you and go from low price to book, high price to book. And if you're not watching the return equity, you're going to be fooled by those accounting games. So that's the whole idea behind the companion variable. Ask that question about the return equity whenever somebody brings up price to book. Amazing how much of the puzzle will disappear in this process. Now let's build on a second thing that we talked about. We talked about revenue multiples, right? So let's say you're looking at the retail business, big business. You got department stores, you got discount retailers, you got luxury retailers, you got online retailers, and you're all looking at them all in one big data set. And you're looking at their revenue multiples, price to sales, EV to sales, pick your poison. If you're looking at revenue multiples across retail firms, holding all else constant, given what you may think about these subsets of firms, which of these firms, if you just pick based on cheap companies, have low EV to sales, if you just pick the companies with the lowest EV to sales, which of these groups is going to look cheap to you? The discount retailers, and here's why. They're going to trade at half of revenue. You say, this is awful, they're cheap. But then you look at their margins, what are you going to see? Really low margins. Even the very best discount retailers have slim margins because they make money by selling a lot at low margins. So if you're not careful, low margin companies are going to look cheap to you on a revenue multiple basis. One more example and we'll put this to rest. This is an old table, I should probably update it, that looked at margins for cell phone companies. You got Apple, you got Samsung, you got BlackBerry, I don't even know why it's hanging in there, Motorola, Sony, Ericsson, LG. I'll cut to the chase. You look at the margins across these companies. See the margins for Apple? 28, 29, 30, 32, 32, 33, 35, 35. That number is down to about 31 now. So Apple's margins on an iPhone are 31%. There's Nokia. 15, 12, 10, 10, 13, 10, 7, 4, heading towards zero. Right? Samsung, not bad, but half the margins for Apple. So I'll save you the trouble. Look across the margins. You see wide differences. The phones may sell for the same price or even roughly the same price, but very different margins. Talked about brand name yesterday, right? The essence of a brand name is pricing power. And the way you measure pricing power is with margins. I know this might reflect just my biases, but just looking at those margins, which of these companies do you think has the strongest brand name? BlackBerry. No, I'm just kidding. But it's Apple, and the reason is, and how can you tell? In fact, there's all these stories about how brand names are coming under assault across the world, across lots of different products. One way you can test that hypothesis is to check margins over time. If you see margins decreasing, that is the ammunition you need to argue that brand names are becoming less valuable. So all of those things we talked about last session, let's continue building off what we did last session by going back to, I think we were on page 53. Okay. So let me review what we did last session. We described the multiple. Remember the statistical properties. Multiples are never normally distributed. They're asymmetric. We talked about how the median is a much more reliable measure than the mean. And how it might make sense to use all of the data rather than just the median or the mean. We talked about analyzing the multiple. Sounds fancy, but we did fancy algebra, right? We took an equity discounted cash flow model, a dividend discount model, and figured out the variables that drive price earnings, price to book, price to sales. And we took an EV valuation, free cash flow to the firm divided by cost of capital minus growth, to come up with the drivers of EV multiples, EV to EBITDA, EV to sales, EV to invested capital. You've done the hard work on pricing now. Let's have some fun. Because now we can use multiples, right? So today's session is going to be applying these multiples. And to apply these multiples, remember when you're doing pricing, you need comparable assets. In real estate, we said that's by looking at other properties in the same neighborhood. SeatGeek, it was other seats in the same section of the stadium. With companies, this gets a little tricky because finding a company similar to yours is usually problematic. You pick up any equity research report, it seems to be easy, right? Because to look at a software company, what do? They compare to other software companies. I give you utility, you compare to other utilities. I give you a social media company, you compare to other social media companies. At least in practice, comparable seems to almost always be defined as other companies in the same sector. But from a valuation perspective, think about it. A comparable firm is not one in the same sector. It's one with similar cash flows, similar growth, and similar risk, right? Nowhere in there is there a software or utility. You say, but I cannot compare a software company to a utility. Why not? In fact, what software company out there is even remotely comparable to Microsoft? Why am I even comparing Microsoft to other software companies when, in fact, I should be comparing it to other companies and other businesses that have significant pricing power and a couple of cash cow products? Who knows? Maybe Google is a much better comparison to Microsoft. So when we think about comparable, one of the things I'm going to push you to do is get out of that box of SIC codes and sectors and industries that we put ourselves into and say, hey, maybe we need to start thinking differently about comparable firms. And no matter how careful you are about coming up with a list of comparable firms, you're going to find that those comparables are different from your company. On any dimension, on growth, on risk, and you have to control for those differences. And right now, the way analysts control for these differences is they tell us stories. They say, this company has higher growth, therefore it has to have a higher PE ratio. I get it, but why this much higher? And that's part of what I want to confront, is if you want to control for differences, we need to get past the storytelling. So this is something that you have to think about when you start to price your company. I know that's the second thing I'd hate to remind you, but now that you've done your DCF valuation of your company, you have to price your company. It's a much simpler exercise, but you're going to confront the question of what should I use as comparables for my company? And I'll give you broadly the choice you're going to face. You can go with a small sample of companies just like yours. I'll use the S&P Capital IQ screening tool to kind of illustrate what I mean. If you ever use the tool, if you've never used it, use it because you have access to it for free. Might as well take advantage of it while you're in school, because if you get out of here and you don't have access to it, it's too expensive to get there. It's incredible because you can screen for whatever you want. So let's say that I want to price Walmart. I could say I want other retailers, and I'll get this huge sample, right? I'll get thousands and thousands of companies. I could say other U.S. retailers, I'll get a smaller sample. I could say other U.S. discount retailers, my sample gets even smaller. I could say other U.S. discount retailers with market capitalizations that exceed $100 billion, and I'm going to end up with Costco and Walmart, and I'll be dancing back and forth between the two. But that's a basic choice you have to face. Should I define comparables strictly and end up with five or six companies, or broadly and end up with 100 companies? I'll give you my biases, and it's purely statistical. I'd rather have a large sample of companies that don't look like mine and control for differences statistically, and we'll talk about how that can be done, than end up with a small sample. Because I'm terrified of small samples. Because all you need is one outlier and everything kind of blows up on you. So when you do comparables, this is a question you always face, especially in today's world. We have 41,800 publicly traded companies around the world. Is do I want to go narrow or do I want to go broad? And I'd rather have a broad sample of companies that don't look like mine and control for differences than a really narrow sample. For a long time in the automobile business in the U.S., there were only three companies, Ford, GM, and Chrysler. And every comparison, every valuation that analysts did was across the three companies. You know how dangerous that is to have three companies in your sample and to dance back and forth between the three? But that's what they did. And their excuse was, what else can we do? Well, here's my solution. The world doesn't end at the U.S. You have other companies, other automobile companies in other parts of the world. Why shouldn't you be comparing GM to Volkswagen and Toyota and Volvo? We have a global sample in most sectors, might as well take advantage of it. So that's something you're going to have to face, and then you're going to have to decide how you're going to control for difference. And I'll give you the choices. One is you can find another company just like yours. Don't ask me how you did this. And make a direct comparison. So I could take AB InBev and SAB Miller and act like the world is just those two beer makers and say, hey, what do they look like relative to each other? It's a direct comparison where you essentially assume the companies are similar enough that you can compare the P/E ratios or EV to EBITDA multiples. The second, as I said, is you tell a story. You say, I'm comparing my company to these 15 other companies, but my company is riskier than these 15 other companies, so I would expect it to trade at a lower multiple than these 15 companies. Remember last week I put up that pricing of Valiant? I just put up my intrinsic valuation of Valiant this morning, so if you're interested, you can check it out in my blog. But in the pricing of Valiant, what I did was I compared it to other pharmaceutical companies with a caveat, which is most of the pharmaceutical companies are not facing the scandal that Valiant is facing right now. So when you come up with the multiple you use for EBITDA or EBITDA before R&D, you have to control for that difference, and you tell a story. You say, I think because of the scandal, Valiant will trade at a lower multiple. The problem with the storytelling is you can't tell me how much lower. So we're going to talk about one way in which analysts try to control for differences, and I kind of opened the door when I talked about PEG ratios. PEG ratios were created because analysts wanted to control for differences in growth. So what they did was they brought it into the multiple. It works sometimes, it does, but you can see why they do it. Dividing the PE by the growth makes them feel better about controlling for growth. But I'm going to push you towards the last approach because I think the most underutilized discipline in investing in business is statistics. It's unfortunate because our statistics classes, if they were taught right, could be the most useful classes ever. But I think that is the most... Because what statistics is designed to do? It's designed to find relationships and check to see whether they're significant. So I'm going to draw on my statistics, the limited statistics I know, to kind of make those comparisons across companies. So you ready? I'm going to play the role of an equity research analyst. I'm going to put out buy recommendations or sell recommendations, and I want you to shoot them down. You know everything you need to know about pricing. So think of this as preparation for the real world out there, because you're going to get hit by people trying to buy and sell stuff from you using multiples. So here's my first job. I'm the beverage analyst. This is my sector. I have only one tool I know how to use, which is PE ratios, and I don't even know how to use it very well. So here's what I do. I compare PE ratios across companies, and I pick the companies with the lowest PE ratios and make them my buy recommendations. You ready? Here's my equity research report coming up. I want you to buy three companies in this sector, and you can already see which three they're going to be. I want you to buy André Wine. Have you heard of them? They're the ones that produce champagne so cheap that when you watch the ads, you get a headache. Right? The only time I ever see those ads is before Christmas. There's usually a sleigh and a guy drinking André Wine, and he's ready to pass out right there. So, no. But they're trading at 8. So you see why I like them. They're trading at less than 10 times. I don't even know what Todd Hunter does, but I'm sure it's something just as cheap, 8.94 times earnings. And Hanson Natural, and you've seen the Hanson sodas, right? So I picked the three companies that trade at less than 10 times earnings. I'm a very naive equity research analyst. I've kind of given you the ammunition already on this page. So tell me why André Wine and Todd Hunter are so cheap. Well, they have terrible growth rates, right? If you look at the growth rates I've given, they have 3 and a 3.5% growth rate. So there goes my buy recommendation. If I just checked the growth rate, they wouldn't have looked that cheap. Oh, Hanson still looks good, right? 17% growth rate. But what's the thing I should worry about? It is the highest risk. So the stocks that look cheap here have some, it doesn't mean they might not be cheap, but I have to control for those differences. And that's what I mean about laziness in pricing. Lots of equity research, you see the buy recommendation, and all you have to do is look below the surface at the growth, at the risk, and say, hey, you know what? Maybe the stock is not cheap. Maybe it deserves to be cheap. The problem here is you're saying, well, I can't go further from there. But at least you can shoot down a lot of equity research right off the bat by just asking that question. So I got fired as a beverage analyst. I landed on my feet, everybody on Wall Street. The worse you do things, the higher up you move in the ranks. So I became the telecom analyst in the late 90s. In the late 90s, if you remember, all these, you know, emerging market European telecom companies, which used to be government-owned, were being privatized. And many of them had ADRs listed in the U.S. So this is my sector, is telecom ADRs. And I'm going to do what comes naturally to me. I'm going to compare PE ratios. I told you, the only tool I have is PE ratios. I'm going to stick with it. So I'm going to put out a buy recommendation on Telebras. Telebras used to be the Brazilian telecom monopoly. It's since been broken up into 7 different telecom companies, but it used to be all of, you know, Telebras, I like Telebras because it trades at 8.9 times earnings. I put out a buy. Buy Telebras, it's cheap. First thing that should worry about Telebras, I've given away on this table, right? Which is, its growth rate doesn't look that good, 7.5%. What else worries you about Telebras? This is the late 90s, and it's the Brazilian telecom company. You know what Brazil looked like in terms of risk in the late 90s? It was immensely risky. So the other thing you worry about is maybe the risk that's keeping the PE ratio down. Now, here are the limits of storytelling. You see on the one hand and the other hand. On the one hand, it looks cheap. On the other hand, it has low growth. On the one hand, it looks cheap. On the other hand, it's risky. I run out of hands after the fourth hand. So I'm going to get rid of my hands, and I'm going to open up my statistics book. What am I trying to explain? Differences in PE ratios. What are the two things I'm worried about? Growth and risk. I don't know whether you remember in statistics class the notion of a dummy variable. This is not a variable created by dumb people because they can't think of variables. A dummy variable takes on the value of 0 or 1. And what I did was I created a dummy variable for this sample. I put in 0 if it was a developed market telecom. So the Danish telecom company, I said, you know, I put in a 0. It's an emerging market telecom company, I put a 1. It's kind of a bludgeon, because I can't figure out any other way to separate the two. I ran the regression of PE ratio against growth rates and that emerging market dummy. Before I look at the coefficients, take a look at the R squared. 66%, is that a good R squared? statistics classes ruin us for life. Right? In statistics classes, if you notice, everything has R-squareds of 95%. And I'll tell you something. If you're running regressions with R-squareds of 95%, you're testing something not worth testing. Things like, is there a relationship between your weight and how much you eat? Is there a relationship between your GPA and how many beers you drink? Yes. You drink 50 beers a week, your GPA is in the toilet because you're never getting out of bed. You eat 15,000 calories a day, you weigh a ton. That guy was sitting next to me on the plane to Las Vegas. But they somehow feel that they show you R-squareds of less than 90%, it's not going to break. Finance, give that up. 66% is about as good as it's going to get. Celebrate. This is good. I'll even take 20%. I'll go down as low as 12%. Desperation drives you to do whatever you can take. Let's look at the coefficients. There's a constant. What does that tell you? How do you read a constant in these regressions? Basically, think of that as the base on which the entire sector is being priced. So if an entire sector is being priced highly, you're going to get a high constant. So you're building off a high base. Don't read it. So there's no intuitive explanation to put in. This is pricing. The market's building off 13.12. See this coefficient in the growth rate? 121.223. Every 1% difference in growth rates in the sector translates into an increase in P/E ratio 1.21. We're starting to put numbers behind our story. So if your growth rate is 5% higher than mine, and you're a telecom company, your P/E ratio should be roughly 6 higher than mine, 5 times 1.21. So now, if you tell me about a higher growth telecom company, I can tell you how much higher your P/E should be. But take a look at this emerging market coefficient, -13.85. You know how you'd read that? You have two telecom companies with the same growth rate. One is a developed market telecom company, and the other is an emerging market telecom company. In the late 90s, the emerging market telecom company would have had a P/E ratio 13.85 lower than the. That is the discount the market was attaching to emerging market company risk in the late 90s. You say, that's too much. Hey, remember, when you're pricing, that's not your job. Your job is to take what the market is doing and say, that's what it is. I'm going to build it in. You don't like it? Do an intrinsic valuation. We can bring in ratings and country risk into cost of capital. This is pricing. Now, why am I doing this? Because I want to figure out whether telecom is cheap. I'm sorry, Telebrass is cheap, right? So what am I going to do? I have the regression. I have the growth rate. I plug in the growth rate of 7.5% and the emerging market dummy, I get a predicted PE for Telebrass of 8.35. It was actually trading at 8.9 times earnings. After I control for its low growth and high risk, what am I finding? Telebrass is actually expensive, not cheap. In fact, take Indosat, which is the other telecom company that looked cheap. It actually, after you control for growth and risk, also comes out as slightly expensive. And that's the point I'm trying to make, is it's easy to let the storytelling get carried, but let the data tell you what the relationship is, and sometimes it can break through the storytelling. Any questions? Yes? Yeah, in fact, the standard errors are right there. So that's a good way to think about it. So when somebody says, how high should my R-squared be for a regression to be statistically significant? I said, don't worry about the R-squared. Look at the standard error and the t-statistics, right? If the standard error is high and the t-statistics, what's a cutoff? Do you remember from statistics? What does the t-statistic have to be before it becomes statistically significant? Once you get above 2, you're talking about significance. You'd like it to be 3, maybe 4. In this case, the t-statistics for growth rate is 6.29, way above. And the t-statistic for the dummy variable is 3.84. So rather than get focused on the R-squared, look at the standard error and the t-statistic. It's a statistically significant relationship. There is noise, which means that when I make my prediction, and some statistics packages allow you to do this, you'll get a range on the prediction. And in this case, guess what? That range will probably put the 8.9 within the range. So when I said Telebrass looks expensive, I was probably overstating the case, because given the R-squared of 66%, the predicted PE for Telebrass was probably between 7.5 and 9.2. So I would look at Telebrass and say, It's close to fairly priced. I'll go on. But what you're looking for are companies that fall outside the bound. But that's a good point about T statistics, because the only time when your prediction is absolutely certain is when. What has to be true about the R squared for you to be certain about your prediction? The R squared has to be 100%. And that's, as I said, never going to happen. So always think about these as ranges. You're getting a range around the distribution. And please, based on this particular sample, Telebras doesn't look cheap. So I get fired as a telecom analyst. Okay? I become the banking analyst. What other sector should I go to? This is a perfect sector for somebody who has no idea what they're doing with valuation. So I land as, I look at European banks. I'm the European banking analyst. I've moved continents now, so nobody knows me. Okay? So these are European banks in 2010. And here I'm going to switch to a price-to-book ratio. Having been burnt with the price-earnings ratio twice, I spent months mastering the price-to-book ratio. I just know what numerator is price and denominator is book. That's what the mastering is. Oh, now landed on my feet. There you have the price-to-book ratios. So again, remember, I want a low price-to-book. But that's all I know, low price-to-book. So I say, everybody buy. This is a problem with German banks, whatever that is. Bear, Rishi, Hippo, and Behrens, B. No. So basically, that looks like a really cheap bank. Why? I can't even name the bank, but price-to-book is 0.8. Buy that bank, which I can't name, that's on top of the list. But already, if you look at the top of the list, I've also listed the return on equity for these banks. Notice something about this list. The banks that have the lowest price-to-book ratio also look like they have the lowest return on equity. The banks that have the highest price-to-book ratio tend to have the highest return on equity. And especially with banks, if you get a chance, download this for banks, you'll notice this relationship is a pretty strong one. Now, we're investors. We're not statistics people, so we're not looking for correlation. We're looking for cheap and expensive banks, right? What you're looking for is a mismatch. What do I mean by a mismatch? You're looking for a bank with a low price to book and a high return on equity. Those are my cheap banks. And the expensive banks are... Now, of course, I can try to eyeball the data, but I'll tell you, in about 5 minutes, you're going to get dizzy, especially if you have a big sample. So here's a very simplistic investment tool. I can compute the median price-to-book ratio and the median return equity for the entire sector, right? In fact, in this sector, the median price-to-book ratio is 2.07, and the median return equity is 11.82%. Then you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to look for all the banks I can find that trade at below the median price-to-book and have a return equity. And it's very simplistic. But basically, I'm looking for... In fact, if I want to bring risk into the equation, I can even bring risk in because I want low price to book, high return equity, and low risk. So I can say I want companies that traded below 2.07 in terms of price to book, have a return equity that exceeds 11.82%, and have standard deviations less than 21.93%. Let's go back and see if we can find some. So I'm looking for stocks below 2.07. So you can cut off all the stocks above, beyond this line. I'm looking for return equity that exceeds what? 11.82%. Oh, there I found one. BNP Paribas, 1.72 price to book, 12.46%. But I have some bad news. The standard deviation number is high. I'll let you in on the secret. I couldn't find a single stock that met all three criteria. But that shouldn't surprise you. These are high-profile banks which are widely followed. You shouldn't expect to see a slam dunk, so you might have to accept some compromise. So your compromise might be, if Paribas has a low price to book, it has a higher return equity than the typical bank. I know it looks riskier, but I'll act like it's not there. Incidentally, I use standard deviation of the stock price as a measure of risk, but if these are banks, what might be a more sensible... When you think about risky banks and safe banks, what do we tend to think of as risky banks? Regulatory capital, right? So what if instead of looking at standard deviation, I looked at your tier 1 capital ratios or tier 2, whatever capital. So what do I want? I want a bank with a low price to book, a high return equity, and a high regulatory capital ratio because then I feel safer. This is what screening is, right? I mean, when you think about running screens, and 95% of portfolio managers, when they say we pick stocks, what they're talking about is running screens. If you can figure out what you're screening for, risk and growth, you essentially have a mechanism you can use to devise whatever screens you need to find cheap stocks. And it doesn't have to be driven by how we think about risk. in intrinsic valuation. You don't have to use betas. You don't have to use standard deviations anymore because you're now in the pricing realm and your job is to figure out what the market is pricing in. In fact, so this is a kind of a simplistic. Take the median, look for stocks, and already you can see it's not giving me much here. I can't find any severely undervalued stocks and any severely overvalued stocks. So I'm going to try a different tactic. I ran a regression of price to book against return in equity and standard deviation so that I bought those numbers. Again, before I ran the regression, I laid down my price. This is called Bayesian statistics. Before you run the regression, just list out what you expect to find. I expected to see that if return on equity was higher, the price to book would be higher. And I expected to see as risk went up, that price to book would be lower. The regression kind of confirmed it. You're saying, what would you have done if it hadn't confirmed it? I'd have still used it, but with a little more queasiness than I use it now. I checked the stand. Those are the T statistics right below. Again, they passed my test of two. The R squared is 79%. I'm not going to get too excited about the high R squared. It's still a small sample. But if I plug the numbers in for each bank into that regression, I get a predicted price-to-book ratio. Now, do you see the basis for my deciding whether something is cheap or expensive? The unpronounceable German bank, which had a price-to-book ratio of 0.8, the predicted price-to-book ratio is 0.89. So if I compare the actual to the predicted, it's undervalued by about 11%. And I do that for every bank in the list. That last column is going to become my basis for my buy and sell recommendations. The cheapest bank here is Royal Bank of Scotland. Thank God I didn't buy it. No. That is the cheapest stock. That is the cheapest stock. The most expensive is Erste Bank, which is, I think, an East European bank, 23.11% above. Again, the reason you have to be very careful, it's built on one regression, one point in time. There are lots of things you don't know about banks. But before you jump on me, remember, this wasn't my tool of choice, right? If you'd given me Erste Bank and asked me whether I should invest in it, my instinct would have been to go to a discounted cash flow model and do it right. So when people say, well, how come you're doing this? I say, you're the ones using pricing. I'm just holding up a mirror to you and saying, do you really want to use a price earnings or a price to book ratio? Because that's it. All the statistics is doing is reflecting the flaws of using multiples, but it's explicit about it. This is the noise. Be careful about the noise. You're building a pricing decision given how the market is pricing everything else. An interesting follow-up. I've been tracking the price-to-book ratios and returns in equity for U.S. banks collectively. And if you look across time, the early part of the last decade, the price-to-book ratios for banks rose, and they rose because returns in equity at banks went up. And we can talk about why that happened. They made money from securitization, the housing boom, etc. 2007, the price-to-book ratio for a typical bank was about 3, and the return equity was about 14%. And then the bottom collapsed, of course, with the crisis. And as the crisis hit, you see the return equity collapse, and as the return equity collapsed, the price-to-book ratio, by the time you got to 2009, was less than 1. So the typical bank in 2009 earned a low return equity and a low price-to-book ratio. But here's, I think, the puzzle, and this is a puzzle that might be the basis for an investment strategy. Returns on equity at banks have climbed back up. They're now up to about 13-14% again. So if you look at 2014-2015, returns on equity are up. But price-to-book ratios at banks have stayed at close to 1. So you can read in one of two ways, right? One is if you can say, well, investors are underpricing banks, I'm going to jump in and buy banks. What's the other explanation that might not lead you to jump in? How do you explain the fact that returns on equity have climbed, but price-to-book ratios haven't? Even if equity is reduced, the price-to-book ratio, be careful. You can't reduce equity too much at a bank because of the regulatory floor, right? Exactly. Remember, the price-to-book ratio is based on expectations of return equity. So what do investors say? Your return equity is high, but I don't believe you. That's basically it. Banks have lost credibility. So when Citi says, we had a good year, people say, really? What are you not telling me? That's the reaction we have to most money center banks now, is they report their earnings and you say, well, that's nice, but where's the bad stuff and when is it coming? This might be a cynical view, but that's what's driving it. But there is, if you feel the market is being too cynical, Don't talk about it. Just go out and buy banks collectively. Buy one of those bank ETFs and sit back and hope that the cynicism goes away. But your biggest fear then would be that the cynicism is well placed, that you're going to get another write-off and another write-off and another scandal and another trading scandal. The next thing you know, your 15% return on equity goes to 7%. But keep track of those two numbers, because I think it's going to be interesting to see how the sector has been changed, I think, permanently by the 2008 crisis. Let's do a fourth example. Now I'm fired as a bank analyst. I'm now a general analyst. I don't know what I'm doing. I look at the entire market. So the start of every year now for about 25 years, here's what I've done. I've gone into a database. It wasn't S&P Capital IQ then, but it's S&P Capital IQ now. I dump out the price-to-book ratios for the 100 largest market cap U.S. companies. I dump out the returns on equity for the most recent year for each of the companies. So it's very simplistic. Price-to-book ratio at a point in time, return equity over the last year. Then I do a scatter plot, right? Sounds fancy, but I just plot each company on this axis. So that's the 100 largest U.S. companies in January 2010, price-to-book ratio on one axis, return equity on another. See, what are these lines you've drawn through? You know what that middle line is? It's just a best fit line. It's the regression line of price to book against return equity. The outer two lines are actually my 90% confidence intervals. When you run a regression, you can actually say these are my bounds. Why am I drawing this? Anything that falls between the two lines, you can't statistically reject the hypothesis that these companies are fairly priced. And you can already see that GlaxoSmithKline has a really high price to book, but it also has a really high return equity. So the companies that fall between the lines, you can say, I can't statistically reject the hypothesis that they're fairly priced. So what are you looking for? You're looking for stocks that fall outside the lines. Where are my cheap stocks on this graph? Below the line or above the line? Below the line. So what are my three cheap companies according to this graph? ExxonMobil, ConocoPhillips, and Nokia. And already a red flag should go up. What's a red flag? Two of my three companies are oil companies. And you're saying, why is that a red flag? What am I using for my return equity? Net income in the most recent year divided by book value of equity. Why might that be an issue? In fact, I wager that if you did this today, a lot of oil companies are still going to come out looking cheap. Why? Because my earnings reflect oil prices that were higher than they are today. The prices reflect where we are today. So I'm saying don't do anything crazy right after you do this graph, like getting online and buying, putting all your money in the three companies. Okay? So with each company, you can see there might be other things. That's why it's a screening device. It's not an investment tool. It's a screening tool. In what sense? Take the three companies and value them. Maybe they are undervalued, but at least now you've got a much more focused search. The three companies that fall above the line were Google, Infosys, and Gilead Systems. As I name those companies, what do you think explains why they fall above the line? They might be expensive, but what am I missing in this graph? I have price to book, return equity. What are the two missing variables? Growth and risk, right? Let's try growth. This is a two-dimensional graph. Can I make it a three-dimensional graph? I hate three-dimensional graphs. I'll be quite honest before I show it to you. They make me dizzy. But in Excel, you can actually create 3D graphs, right? It's like a big cardboard box. Let me ask you a question. Where are my cheap stocks now? Which corner of this box should I be putting my hand and searching? Let's try this out. You want low price to book or high price to book? You want low price to book. You want high return equity. You want low beta or high beta? Low beta. So basically, you're looking in this corner. Oh, bad news, there's nothing there. The closest you get is actually ExxonMobil. But you see what the objective here is? You want to find something that's a mismatch, but these are the 100 largest market cap companies in the U.S. You're not going to find something so absurdly mispriced, but you're looking. You're looking to see how close you can get to that corner of that box. Now, since you're already dizzy from looking at this, I don't think I can do a four-dimensional graph. But I still stayed with three-dimensional, but I made it risk. I also tried growth. Where in this graph would I find my cheap stocks? I want low price to book, high return equity, low growth or high growth? High growth, so I'm looking there. The closest I get is Time Warner. It's pricing. You want to price, I'll price with you. I don't like it, but I'll price with you. That's basically what pricing is. You can cover it up as much as you want, but this is the process of pricing. So finally, since I can't run a four-dimensional graph, I said, let me get rid of these graphs. Because once you go beyond three dimensions, you have to give up on graphs. It's not easy to show it as a picture. So I ran a regression of price to book against beta, growth, and return equity. This is the 100 largest market cap companies. Again, R squared of 66%, not bad for a sample of 100 very, very different companies, which include Google at one end and GlaxoSmithKline at the other. There are my coefficients. The higher the beta for the company, the lower the price to book. Makes sense. The higher the growth for the company, the higher the price to book. Makes sense. The higher the return equity in the company, the higher the price to book. Makes sense. And I can go beyond this. I can take this regression and do what? Plug in the numbers for each of the 100 companies. I can be a one-person hedge fund. Right? Plug in the numbers, buy the companies that have price-to-book ratios less than their predicted value, sell the companies or sell short on the company, and then pray and hope that they all move towards the regression line. That's the uncontrollable variable. Right? Have you taken a look at the mystery project yet? Actually, let me rephrase the question. I'll act like you have taken a look at the mystery project. Because if you have, this is the mystery project. I've given you 183 large market cap companies. I've given you every conceivable number you could ask me for that I can find. So there's some things you got. You want growth, I'll give you 15 different growth numbers. You want risk, I'll give you 10 different risk numbers. You have to decide. So you have lots of choices to make, but this is where you're going. You want something that you can use and you feel comfortable with, that you can say, this will give me predicted values for each company, and this is what looks cheap to me. Those are your five undervalued and five most overvalued companies. So I update this to January 2015. Let's see what looks cheap and expensive now. Above the line, I've got Colgate, Palmolive, you've got Celgene, you've got Amazon. Below the line, I have IBM. Interesting. And that's all I'll say, interesting. Because if I were interested in using this, you know what the next thing I would do is? I'd pull up all the numbers for IBM and do an intrinsic valuation. That's my instinct. To me, this is screening. And this is why I think as portfolio managers, if you just stop there and say, well, I'm going to buy everything that looks cheap, you've stopped with just below the line, which is with whatever your version of a regression is, and saying that's cheap, that's expensive. No. It's easy to do. It takes about 15 minutes to do. Pick any market you're interested in, any sector you're interested in. Run a scatter plot, if nothing else, so you can see what looks cheap and what looks expensive. And who knows? It might be the basis for your next great investment. Okay. So I got fired as that analyst, too. I couldn't even do that. Now I'm back on the floor as a trucking analyst. Think about a boring sector. This is my penalty for all the sins of my past. You're now the trucking analyst. So that's the trucking sector. Impossible to read, so don't try to read what's on the table. I made it really small so you can't even read what's on there. That way you can't ask me the tough questions. That's another strategic choice you can make as an analyst, is either translate everything into a different language that nobody can read. Use Roman numbers. That'll make them everybody confused. Okay? But I'm going to put out a buy recommendation here on a company that you're all probably familiar with. I like Ryder Systems. The multiple I'm using is EV to EBITDA. File that away, because remember the variables that drive EV to EBITDA, we talked about them last session. Why do I like Ryder Systems? It trades at 2.8 times EBITDA. That's like free, right? 2.8 times EBITDA, well below the 6. In fact, the entire sector traded at 5.6 times EBITDA. So I said, looks cheap. It trades at 2.8 times EBITDA. Does anybody remember the variables? Because if you remember the variables, you can ask me the questions before you decide that Ryder Systems is cheap. What's the first question you're going to ask me? We talked about this specifically that shows up when you do EBIT or EBITDA that did not show up when you did net income. What's my tax rate, right? Because remember, we talked about tax rates being... Well, not a problem. In this case, Ryder Systems' tax rate is very similar to everybody else's. So that's, you can cross it out. I said, ask about return on capital. Maybe Ryder Systems has an awful return on capital. That's not the answer either. Ryder Systems' return on capital looks very much like everybody else's. You said, what about growth? Well, they're all boring, low-growth companies. Ready, right? Jump online, buy Ryder Systems. I have to add one more thing about the trucking sector that might affect your decision. You know how we do reinvestment in a regular company, you buy land, you build factories, you do R&D? Trucking sector has a very strange reinvestment pattern. They replace their entire fleet, but they do it once every 5 or 6 years. Why? Because they get a much bigger discount if they do it in bulk. You see, who cares? So ask me the last question about Ryder Systems. When did I last replace my fleet? I actually went in, because that data is available in trucking company 10-Ks. I pulled up the age of the fleet for each of them. Ryder Systems had the oldest fleet in the business. You see what the danger you're going to do? You're going to buy this company thinking it's cheap. And what are you going to read in the Wall Street Journal 2 weeks later? That it's borrowing $3 billion to replace its entire fleet. There goes your EV to EBITDA blowing up on you. And again, my point is, it's there in the 10-K. This was from an actual equity research report. I saw the buy recommendation. That's curious. Let's see what's going on. It took about 30 minutes to pull the numbers off to, in a sense, say, how come you didn't even ask the question? And you could have still come to the conclusion you did, but at least you'd have checked the numbers. So walk into an investment bank into that equity where they have all those equity research reports where nobody's looking. Pick one of each. Leave very quickly. Then go back home, read through the equity research reports. I'm not saying all equity research analysts are lazy. You can separate the good from the bad analysts simply by looking at whether they ask the right follow-up questions. So price all you want, but at least have the good sense to ask those questions you need to ask before you move on. So when you look at Ryder Systems, it looks cheap until you bring in that reinvestment question. And in this case, the reinvestment question is going to take the form of, when did you last replace your fleet? So think about this as a process of asking the right questions whenever you're presented with a multiple. Let's keep moving. I'm now off the trucking business. I'm now the grocery business, even more boring. This was in 2007. Look at all the grocery companies. They have low margins and low EV to sales, or low price to sales. I should really have used EV to sales, but the rankings would have been the same. Do you see the one outlier in 2007? Hanging out there. It's like a Christmas tree ornament up there. Whole Foods. And of course, what made Whole Foods different was it looked like nothing like any other grocery store. When you charge 4 times what people will pay for eggplant, your margins can be really good, and Whole Foods had these really high margins. It's trading at a really high price to sales ratio. And of course, the equity research analyst just said, storytelling. Whole Foods has a high price to sell, but it's okay because its margins are high. In fact, that's exactly the story I had. I said, okay, the story makes sense. But how high? I can understand it should be higher than the typical grocery company, but why 3 times as high? So again, I took the sector, I took the price to sales ratio in the sector and ran a regression against just the margin. Price to sales net margin. There's my regression. I plugged in Whole Foods profit margin into the regression. I came up with a predicted price to sales ratio of 0.43. So you're right, that's higher than the typical grocery store, but it's lower than the 1.41. It is. At least looking at the other grocery stores, Whole Foods looked overpriced. 2 years later, I took the same sector, ran the regression. I took Whole Foods. Notice where Whole Foods, remember where it used to be? Look where it is now. It is, in fact, the most underpriced grocery store in the business. Plugged in its price, its net margin, predicted price to sales of 0.36, it's trading at 0.31. It's gone from being massively overpriced to significantly underpriced. Okay. I reran the regression in 2010. I know it's kind of tough to see where Whole Foods is now, but I kind of find it for you. It should be right there. It's got, you know, back to being overpriced. Overpriced, underpriced, overpriced. Does manic depressive come to mind when you look at this? It's not like the market can't quite decide, right? It overshoots, it undershoots, it's back to overshooting. Then I took 2011. Now, we're at steady state for the moment. Whole Foods is on the line exactly. Didn't last very long. But that's, I think, something that happens when you have an outlier company in a sector. Analysts have no idea what to do with the company. As you look at Valiant, remember that that is something that has made Valiant a tough company for equity research analysts. Because they were used to Pfizer and Merck and Upjohn and GlaxoSmithKline. And what did those companies all do? They did big R&D and you waited 15 years and you got it. And what did Valeant do? They went out and acquired a company, took a drug, pushed up the price, tried to get the highest margin they could. And the reality is analysts have no idea what to do with these outliers. I'm going to show you one final graph because it shows you that Whole Foods, how Whole Foods has shifted over time. This is grocery stores in January 2015. Notice there's a new outlier in town. Sprouts. If you've never heard of it, it's actually a California-based, you know, again, very much like Whole Foods, high-priced, high-margin store. And this might be the next company to watch because I'll wager that you're going to see the same thing happen to Sprouts that you saw with Whole Foods. You're going to see it overpriced, and then it's going to report something that's going to disappoint people. The bottom's going to drop out. It's going to get underpriced, overpriced. Eventually, analysts and investors learn to deal with these companies. But you know what? That's our zone of opportunity, is pick companies that are different in a sector, because if people are pricing these companies, this might be the place where intrinsic valuation will let you get ahead of the curve, saying, you know what? You're pricing these companies. You're mispricing them because you're using a metric that's not right for this company. So think of it as an opportunity. Take every sector. There are a couple of outliers in that sector. Focus on those outliers and see if you can bring the tools of the trade to look at those companies. Remember that Amazon valuation I did in early 2000 that I showed you? My intrinsic value was 34. The stock was at 84. I concluded the stock was massively overvalued based on discounted cash flow valuation. I decided to do a pricing of Amazon at that same time rather than an evaluation. So what I did was I looked at every .com company that was listed and traded in early 2000, and I did a scatter plot of price-to-sales ratios against margins. Why price-to-sales? It's the only multiple I could actually compute for most of those companies. In fact, there was only one company in the entire sector that was making money. AOL. Everyone else was losing money. So when you look at the price-to-sales ratio, look at how the axis goes. It goes from a minus 100% to 0%. Almost everybody's on the wrong side of zero. So I put the scatter plot up. What are you trying to do? You're trying to fit a line through these points, right? Before I even try to look at that, try to fit a line, what does that look like? It looks like a shotgun blast. If I try to fit a line, and I can try, I know exactly what I'm going to get, and I found it. I fit a line. The R-squared was 4%. I know I accept low R-squareds, but 4%, you're really scraping the bottom of the barrel. But here's the even scarier piece of output. Look at the coefficient on net margin. How do you read that? The more negative your net margin, the higher your price-to-sales ratio. You can see why companies took this too hard in the late 90s, right? You lose $1 billion, we can lose two. You lose two, we can lose four. The market says, great, you're losing $4 billion. You must be a really valuable company. So a very cynical view. If I were writing a book on irrational exuberance, you can use this as exhibit once and look how crazy people are. But I think it's a little unfair because people weren't pricing these companies based on their net margins last year, right? You'd be crazy to do it. What were they pricing it on? Promise and potential. So I need my regression to have promise and potential. So I went to S&P Capital IQ and I looked for promise. No column. Potential. None. So I had to get desperate. So here's what I used. And I'll give you my hypothesis here and you tell me what you think about it. I made the assumption that this price-to-sales ratio would have to come down as your sales went up. Do you see why? If you have only $1 million in revenues, I could trade at 100 times revenues. But if you get to $1 billion, it's going to be tough to scale that up. So the first hypothesis I had was the higher your revenues, the lower your price-to-sales ratio should be. Second, I assumed that if you had a higher growth rate in revenues, because there's nothing else that I could even track, you should trade at a higher price-to-sales ratio than if you have a lower growth rate. I'm focused on revenue growth. And third, in a sector like this one, most companies are young. What is it I fear the most? That a company will not make it, right? I need something that captures the risk that a company will not make it. And if you look at young tech companies, when did they shut their doors? What causes them to shut their doors? What did they run out of? Cash. That's it. If you run out of cash and you can't raise capital, the game is over. In fact, equity research analysts in the late 90s came up with a ratio called the cash burn ratio. Have you ever heard of this? where you take the cash balance of a company, you take the EBITDA, which is usually a negative number, and you look at how many months of cash the company has before it runs out of cash. And the more cash you have, the more months of cash you have, the safer you are as a company. I did my own version of it. I took the cash balance of each company and divided by the revenue. So you see what I'm trying to do here? I'm trying to make my regression forward-looking and reflect the sector I'm in. So I ran a regression of price to sales against revenues. I took the log of revenues because otherwise you had AOL with a billion plus and companies with a million. The difference was too wide. So I took the log of revenues, which basically kind of compresses the difference. I took revenue growth and I took cash as a percent of revenue. I got an R squared of 32%. In this sector, I was delighted. I said, this is great. I can take that. I plugged in the numbers for Amazon into this regression. And remember, this is at exactly the same time that I thought Amazon was massively overvalued. When I plugged in the numbers in for Amazon, I came up with a predicted price to sales ratio for Amazon of 30.4. Its actual price to sales was 25.6. So I'm going to pose a question about, and this is a question you're going to face when you price something. At exactly the same point in time that I'm claiming that Amazon is expensive on an intrinsic value basis, massively overvalued, I am also saying Amazon looks cheap in this regression. How can a stock be both expensive and cheap at the same time? I mean, how would you differentiate between those two statements? When I did my intrinsic valuation and said it was expensive, what was I saying? Given the cash flows, growth, and risk in this company, I would not pay $84, right? That's what an intrinsic valuation does. What am I saying in this regression? How would I, if you ask me to describe in words what this finding is, what am I saying when I say Amazon is cheap? Given how the market is pricing other dot-com companies, Amazon looks cheap. You see how the two can give you different answers? Because the market is overpricing all dot-com companies. You can look cheap relative to your sector, but you can be expensive at the same time. And that's something I want you to remember when you see buy and sell recommendations in equity research reports. When an equity research analyst says, I think Square is cheap, and it'll happen, right? After the IPO, somebody's going to put out a buy recommendation on Square. What's he saying? He's saying, given these eight other, whatever, cloud, whatever he decides, given these other eight other cloud companies, Square, and he's not lying. That may be technically true, but you and I as investors don't have to stay with his eight-company comparison. So we have to make our own decisions, and that's the difference in pricing and valuation. Is pricing is about making relative judgments. Valuation is about making absolute judgments. They both have a place in investing, but that's why you can get different answers. On your company, when you do your relative valuation, don't be surprised if you get a different answer than you got the discounted cash flow valuation. And how you deal with that difference is really much more important than what you finally decide as what you do. Because to me, that's the process you have to go through in investing, is you have to dance the dance between value and price and make your best judgments. Now, the other way in which people deal with young sectors, you know what the problem with dot-com companies was, right? And I tried to compute a multiple, there wasn't much there. The revenues were small, the income was small. So I was trying to compute multiples on numbers that were really small. So what some analysts do is they use forward multiples. So what happens is with young companies, they'll project out the revenues or project out the earnings or project out the EBITDA 5 or 10 years out. They'll apply a multiple to the EBITDA. So let's take an example. Let's suppose you took Twitter, and you're the equity research analyst. There's not much there right now. So what you do is you say, 10 years from now, I think Twitter's going to make $1 billion. You say, okay. And you say, 10 years from now, I expect to see social media companies trading at 15 times earnings. I say, okay. Then you take 15 times $1 billion, you got your estimated value 10 years from now. That's called a forward multiple and estimated value. Lots of analysts do it. I have no problem with that, but you have to remember that there's many a slip between the cup and the lip. That if you can get a really high number in 10 years, but if you ask me how much am I willing to pay for that stock today, it can be a much, much lower number. And to see all the things that can eat away at your value, I took an intrinsic valuation I did of Tesla. This is way back when I first valued Tesla. I came up with a value at the end of year 10. My terminal value was $68 billion. The stock was trading at $30 billion. My intrinsic value was $8 billion. So I put this valuation up, and the first reaction I got from Tesla fanatics was you came up with 68 billion in year 10. How come 68 billion became 8 billion? So I took them through the process of why my 68 billion became 8 billion. The first thing I said was there's time value of money. They said time value of what? Time value of money. So basically, even if you took the risk-free rate and you said there's no risk in Tesla, the 68.27 billion becomes 52 billion. So that's the first slice gone is pure time value. Then I said, you know what, there's risk in Tesla. So if I use the cost of capital instead of the risk-free rate, this 52 billion becomes 27.75 billion. That's another 24 billion gone. And then remember, I have all those negative free cash flows in years 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5. Who's going to come up with that? That's the dilution that's going to come in. So if I take the present value of those negative cash flows, the 27.7 becomes 12.8 billion. So I've gone from 68 to 52 to 28 to 12.8. I'm not quite done. If you think there's a chance your company will not make it through the 10 years, that's going to lower the value another, in this case, I assumed a 10% likelihood they would not make it to 12.2 billion. And then remember, you also have debt and cash you have in the company, so that lowers it to about 11.8 billion. And then you take into account the options you've been given away, like their free currency, the value goes to 8 billion. 68 to 8, and you can see at each stage how. So all I'm saying is you don't have to do this explicitly, but when you see these forward multiples and a value in year 5 of 50 billion, 30 billion, don't just look at that number in today's prices. That looks pretty good to me, because there's many an adjustment you have to make, and by the time you finish those adjustments, especially with young companies, you're going to be amazed at how much lower the value is today than the value that you have on your own spreadsheet 10 years out. So those of you valuing young companies, if you want to try this on your DCF valuation, you can actually do it, because I've got your terminal value in year 10. You got your value. You can actually see how you got from that number to today's number. It's a great exercise in understanding where value gets lost in a young growth company, if you're an equity investor early in the process. Here's the third solution. So the first one, I tried to come up with these measures for promise and potential. The second one, I went out in the future and tried to attach a value. The third is you throw up your hands and say, look, I don't know what the market's pricing these things on. Let the numbers tell me what's driving the price. Let me explain. In October of 2013, I valued Twitter at the time of its IPO. It's on my blog, you can go check it out. I came up with a value, I think, about $18 per share. The stock was priced at 22, then it was pushed up to 26, it opened at 46, it went up to 76. My value, you know, got adjusted along the way. But the $18 per share was the IPO value. In October of 2013, I also tried to price Twitter. Now you already see what that exercise involves, right? Going and finding other companies that investors would compare Twitter to. So I put up publicly traded social media companies. That's a very broad list. Some are, you know, companies like Groupon that make their money from very differently than Facebook does. But those are the companies that were publicly traded. There's the market cap of each company. And I went and collected every piece of information I could on a company, revenues, EBITDA. And I went on a search exercise. What was I looking for? I was looking to see what the market was pricing these companies on. Why were some companies higher priced and lower priced? So you know how I answer that question? What am I looking for? What's a variable that best explains prices, right? Remember correlation matrices in statistics? We just take all the variables and say, tell me what's correlated with what. Take a look at the first column, because that's a column I'm going to use. I'm going to look for the variable that has the highest correlation with market cap. Ignore enterprise value, because obviously it's highly correlated, because almost all the market cap is enterprise value. But if you go down the list, it's not revenue, it's not EBITDA, it's not net income, it is number of users. That's it. You tell me how many users you have, go pay the pay. Market's paying on average about $100 per user. You ready? Let's price Twitter. At the time of its IPO, Twitter had 240 million users. You're the investment banker. Your job is to price Twitter, not to value it, to price it. Market's paying $100 per user. You have 240 million users. What price should I attach to Twitter? 24 billion, which is actually very close to the $46 per share you saw on the opening day. You think this is so unsophisticated. Who cares whether it's sophisticated? It works. Your job is to price things. If I told you that people were pricing houses based on the number of chimneys on the house, you know what you do, right? You'd count the chimneys. You'd multiply by 150,000. You have six chimneys, $900,000 house. Of course, there is this problem then that owners will then start adding chimneys to push up the price of the house. But that's the nature of pricing. People are going to play the game. And in fact, that's exactly the insight that I used when I tried to figure out why Facebook paid $19 billion for WhatsApp. Because when they bought WhatsApp, WhatsApp had almost no revenues and it was making no money. But what was WhatsApp's big plus? It had 450 million users, 350 million of whom were unique. They were not on Facebook already. So what was Facebook buying when it bought WhatsApp? It was buying 350 million users. What's the market paying per user? $100 per user. 350 times 100 is $35 billion. Facebook got a bargain at $19 billion. It's a very perverse way of thinking about things, but that is the way to think about what's driving this particular business. It's why when you have these young social media companies, what do? They want you as a user. They don't want you to pay. Just come on in. We want to count you as a user. You think they're being nice. You know why they want to count you as a user? Because when they go to the VC, they say, look, we have 2 million users. Multiply that by 100. The fact that you don't charge them any money is kind of irrelevant right now. It's a pricing game. The only problem is that bar mitzvah moment we talked about. At some point in time, what's the market going to suddenly start to ask you? You have a lot of users, but when are you going to start making money? And you say, what, you want me to make money? This was never in the original contract. It was users, users, more users, pay dividends with users. We can deliver them to you. You just, you know, send 2 users out to each investor. That's the bar mitzvah moment, and that's why when you're a founder of these companies, you have to deliver what the market wants, users, but you almost have to, in parallel, start thinking about that bar mitzvah moment, which means you got to put mechanisms in place to convert those users into revenues, earnings, and cash flows. And that's the difference between Facebook and Twitter. Facebook, right from the beginning, bought users, but it also recognized that these users had to be... If nothing else, that's what you got to give Mark Zuckerberg credit for. He's run the company as a business. He knows ultimately, whereas Twitter didn't quite get this. So when their bar mitzvah moment came last October, they said, what? We have a lot of users. Look, we're increasing users. And they said, we don't care. Your revenues don't seem to be coming in. And that's Jack Dorsey's big challenge, is taking those users and making them into revenues. So keep that. If you're investing in Twitter like I am right now, that's what I'm focused on. Because ultimately at 27, I said, no, price is right. And that's not a game show. Price is right here. I'm buying. But to me, this is the focus of my narrative, is can they convert these 340 million users, which is what they have right now, into revenues and earnings? I don't know that they can. But the optionality is big enough that if they can, I think they're worth significantly more than the $27 per share. So that's pricing, and you can already see it play out. Lots of different sectors. And what you use, what multiple you use, what you control for, can vary across sectors. Now, when I run these regressions, I'm controlling for differences across companies, right, in growth and risk. And if I can control for differences in fundamentals, the question is, why do I stay sector-focused? Why these small samples? Why can't I look at the entire market? Think of how much bigger your sample is. So I'm going to close this process by trying something. I'm going to say, look, I'm going to look at the entire market. Plus is, I now have a much bigger sample. The minus is, there's a lot more noise in the process. So I decided to try to see if I could explain price-earnings ratios across the entire market. Now, the story of price-earnings ratios is they're driven by growth expectations, right? So I said, let me check to see if that's true. I took the price-earnings ratio for every stock in the U.S. that had a P.E. ratio. The reason I say that is you lose about, remember, we lost about 60% of our sample, so that's gone. I took the expected growth rate for every company that has an expected growth rate, which means I'm losing companies which have no analysts. But I still end up with a sample of about 2,000 plus companies. I create a scatter plot. When you see that plot, what's your first reaction? This is crazy. It looks like a line going straight up. I try to fit a regression line, and that line, I fit the line, but I'll also tell you the R squared is going to look awful. So what I'm setting you up is when I show you a regression for the entire market for the PE ratio, remember those R-squareds of 66% and 79%? It's not going to happen here. So I'm preparing you for some disappointment. And guess what? I delivered. The R-squared for this regression, this is a regression of PE ratios against the variables across the entire market, is 35.5%. You think that's awful. It is what it is. Across the market, there's a lot of stuff you can't explain. But there is enough stuff that you can explain, because when you look at the T statistics that I got for beta, payout, and growth, why those three variables? Because that's what showed up when I did my algebra, right? Through cost of equity. So this isn't a kitchen sink regression. Remember kitchen sink regressions? In statistics classes, we do them. Well, what's the objective in a kitchen sink regression? What's the end game? You want the highest R squared you can. So you throw in whatever you need to. Maybe the weight of the CEO. Maybe companies with fat CEOs have higher P ratios. Hey, remember, it doesn't have to make sense. It just has to push up your R squared. So I stopped only with the three variables because if fat CEOs have higher P/E ratios, then I want to buy companies with really, really thin CEOs because that's not a reason for pushing up the P/E ratio. So I stopped with the three variables. All three are statistically significant. Higher beta companies have a P/E ratio of about 3.25. For every increase of 1 in your beta, your P/E ratio goes down by 3.25. Every 1% increase in growth rate increases your P/E ratio by 0.17. And every 1% increase in your payout ratio increases the P/E ratio by 0.17. And every 1% increase in your growth rate increases your P/E ratio by 0.99. I have probably violated every rule in a statistics book with this regression. Let me take you back to your statistics class. Run a multiple regression. And you have independent variables like I do. What's supposed to be true about the relationship between the independent variables? They're supposed to be uncorrelated, right? And if they're correlated, your statistic professor freaks out. He gives it a name, multicollinearity. What the heck are you talking about? Do you think my three variables are independent of each other? What do you think, when I take high growth companies, what should I expect to see as betas usually for these companies? High betas or low betas? And what do I expect to see as payout ratios? So you're usually going to get high growth, high beta. So in other words, these three variables are horribly correlated. How correlated are they? I actually ran the correlation matrix just to show you how bad the regression is. If this were a good regression, all these coefficients that are off the diagonal should be zero. Right? Because beta should be uncorrelated. They're not zero. In fact, I put in, see these stars? That basically means that not only is there a correlation, but it's statistically significant. High payout ratio companies tend to have much lower betas. High payout ratio companies tend to have much lower growth rates. Again, it's the intuition you'd expect, but we have a multicollinearity problem. And this is our statistics class, and you turned in this regression, you failed the class. This is not a statistics class. Frankly, I don't care of the multiple, because what I care about is, does it work in forecasting P/E ratios? And here's the good news. When you have multicollinearity, the overall regression actually still can be used. What you cannot read are the individual coefficients, and here's why. When I've run these regressions, and I've run them for 25 years now, there have been time periods where betas have positive coefficients. Which makes no sense, right? Because usually if beta goes up, the risk goes up, P/E ratio should go down. But in about half these regressions, betas have positive coefficients. You say, what the heck is going on? What's going on there? What does the computer see when you put in four columns of numbers? It sees four columns of numbers. It doesn't see beta growth. So let's say most of your high beta companies also tend to have high growth. You know what's going to happen? The computer gets really confused about whether beta is measuring risk or whether beta is measuring growth. That's what multicollinearity does, is it mingles the effect of the variables, which means that I should be careful about taking one of the coefficients and building a story on it, but I can still use the overall regression. And how am I going to use it? You come to me with a company, let's say Disney, and say, I want to know whether Disney is cheap or expensive. I could do an intrinsic valuation, but let's say I don't have the time for that. Let's say I told you that Disney has a beta 1.25, an expected growth rate of 15%. These are all analyst estimates of growth. So I took the analyst estimate of growth for Disney and a 20% payout ratio. There's my P/E ratio regression. If I plug in the numbers into this regression, and I think I did actually plug it in so I can tell you what I got. I got 20.10. So basically, when I plug in Disney's numbers, I get a predicted PE for Disney of about 20. So what? How? In fact, if you were characterizing the 20 to somebody who has no idea what statistics is and what the regression is, how do you characterize the 20? What am I saying when I say the P/E ratio for Disney should be 20? Given how the market is pricing every other stock, and given what Disney's numbers look like, this is what the P/E ratio. It's a pricing. It's a big pricing judgment as opposed to pricing against the sector. So you plug the numbers in, you get a P/E ratio of 20 times earnings. It's actually trading at 20 times earnings. So what am I going to do? Move on. There are 7,870 other companies out there. Why the heck should I sit there banging my head? And the nice thing is you don't have to do this company by company by company, right? You have an Excel spreadsheet with 7,870 companies. You plug in the regression equation. You can get predicted PEs for every single company. Remember I talked about being a one-person hedge fund? I'm not kidding. You could take 7,870 companies. How much time does it take to add that additional column? The only thing is your regression better work. Your hedge fund's going to come apart at the seams. But given how badly other hedge funds do, you might still come out as a winner. The average alpha for hedge funds last year was what? Minus 1%. It doesn't take a lot to beat minus 1%. Okay? Pick 2,000 stocks at random, you'll beat minus 1%. Okay. So maybe all this will do is create enough noise that you lose only minus 0.3%. Say, I'm a winner. Send all your money to me, 2 and 20. One final point. Remember that coefficient on growth, 0.99 that I got? I've been running this regression, as I said, for a really long time. And the way to read that coefficient is that's what the market's paying for growth right now. It's a market price for growth. And if you remember, when we talked about equity risk premiums way back in the class, that was a market price for risk. Right? The implied equity risk premium. So what I did in this table was actually put the market price for growth from my regression and the implied equity risk premium. So let's go back to January 2000, peak of the dot-com boom. What is the market charging for risk? Almost nothing. What was it paying for growth? A huge amount. If you're a high-growth, high-risk company, you can see why this is nirvana, right? Can't get any better. The market's not punishing you for being risky. It's giving you this huge payoff of being growth. If you are a high-risk, high-growth company, your P/E ratio is going to be 150. But how things can change. 1 year later, or 2 years later, you look at what the market's paying for growth. It's dropped by almost 50%. And what it's charging for risk has increased by about 80%. So imagine being the same high-growth, high-risk company that was glorified in January 2000. How's the market going to be treating you in January 2002? Much more badly, right? The same growth is now worth less. The same risk is being charged for more. And this is, I think, something I try to get across to CEOs of high-tech companies. Is you can do whatever you want within the company, but you are at the mercy of the market in terms of how it's pricing growth and risk. So you can have the same growth and the same risk you had 2 years ago, but your price can change dramatically if it's a pricing game. Okay. Let's stop there. I don't think you can take any more graphs today. No.
So you can try lags. If the lags work, use them, because that's the price. So you can try 1 year lags, 2 year lags, you can try contemporaneous. And it's not a question of what time you should expect to find. client because it doesn't matter. It's what the market is doing. So maybe the market is pricing things based on trailing 12-month numbers.
Yeah.
Maybe it's pricing on 2 years ago numbers. But you're looking, and that's why you have these institutions. You can't reason your way into the right answer. Because there is no right answer. Whatever the market is.
Yeah.
So that's why you can try lags, but do it because you want to find something that explains.
Yeah, something like predictable or something like
you could normalize, you could, you know, you could make all kinds of hypotheses, right? That's why I've given you the information for 10 years of net income. You say, look, I don't like to use it, because that's what the market is going to do. Look at normal, but remember, do it always with the data telling you what to do. Don't get so caught up in, I have a really good story about why normalized earnings should matter. Therefore, I'm going to use normalized earnings. It doesn't matter how good the story
is. Are the price also like the trailing 12 months or like the price of the stock?
Price has to be right now because it has to be actionable. What are you going to do with the trailing 12 month price?
Okay.
Because you have to buy today. So everything using the regression has to be actionable. Using an average price makes no sense because an average price is not a transaction.
Okay. So I'm trying to define a ratio to compare banks. Why so? A ratio of risk for the bank. I want to compare with some similar risk to banks. So can we agree up to number one? So the typical regulatory capital to asset base.
That's what a capital like this is. So you have to define which version of regulatory capital. Capital like this, tier one, tier two, and tier three.
Okay. So that's one. What is it? Rating both banks? No?
And that's because you're a bank. You can't get the point. Yeah. You down. So you're going to go A through triple X. There's not going to be much room to run. And it's an average. You can't run a regression on an average. Oh, you want to use the spread that goes with the rating?
The percentage, what is
it? Risky bank is not one that's going to be borrowing 5% of the risk free, right? Because you wouldn't survive as a bank. You'd shut you down before the bank.
Okay.
So default spread's not going to work.
I'm trying to get fancy also.
What did you
say? Is it rating defined by whatever risk free? Plus
anything to do with default spread, it's not going to work.
Not going to work. Nothing.
Because they're going to shut. Any risky bank, any bank with high default risk, is going to be shut under the regulator.
Right.
Right. That's why you don't have double B rated banks or single B or even triple B rated banks.
Okay.
Right. You have to have enough buffer
with
the regulatory authority. That's why the regulatory capital ratio acts as a speed buffer before you get there. Right? They want to make sure by keeping your regulatory capital ratio that you don't become a double B rated bank.
Okay.
So I think regulatory capital is going to be a good
One last question.
Yeah.
Like the regulatory capital depends on the country you're operating, basically.
No, it's Basel. It's global, right? It's global.
Okay.
It's global. So tier one actually is a global. There might be differences across countries, but actually globally there are requirements that you have to
face. Perfect. Okay, thank you. First, why does it take a lot of the...
Any card is actually statistical from any variables have a huge range. Much bigger rates on independent variable, the regression is going to get very, very problematic.
Right.
So when you have an independent variable where the highest revenue company is 50 billion in revenue, let's say you take retail,
right.
You have Walmart with 300 billion, when you have some really small retail companies with a million, they're both going to snappily drive down the regression. The difference across the independent variable is so large, it'll drown out. So all you need is a couple of outliers. It's too big a difference. So what natural laws do is they, if you take the natural log of 300 billion, the natural log of 1, you would still get the same ranking, but it would be a much more compressed ranking. So just a technique that works anytime you have a independent variable that has too wide a range. Market cap, you use it, revenue, you use it, because you have too many big differences. You might not ever do it. If your sample is just 100, you know, companies with revenue between 100 and 300 million, you don't have to take lots. The difference is much narrower. They take all retailers, you've got to control the difference in revenue.
And what do you use?
I used SPSS, but you can use Minitab, you can use even Excel to get the analysis tool.
It comes in
a new map. The 2016 version has it, the 2008 version had it, the 2011 version lost it. So it depends on which version of the Mac.
Okay.
You have the 2016 version analysis tool. But Excel is not a great tool for regressions because it requires the variables to be in rigorous columns. So
So about three independent variables that can be called D, E, and F. And if they're D, F, and K, Excel doesn't know what to do because it doesn't let you pick those columns. It's a pain in the neck. That's why it's better to use a statistics package, because then you can do the kind of complementary tests on key statistics. And
so which do you recommend?
I use SPSS, which comes from the manual. But the only reason I use SPSS is one of the few